Your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
This could be a good time to negotiate your compensation. After all, unemployment is near a 50-year low, and wage growth has been, and this may be surprising to me, it's been twice as high for the bottom half of earners than for the top half of earners. But is it a good time for you to ask for a raise? Here are a few questions that may help you make that decision. Are you at least an average performer compared with your peers? These days, you don't need to be a superstar. Just average is probably good enough. Do you believe you're underpaid in cash or benefits compared to your peers? Has your job grown more difficult, maybe more technological, since your previous salary was set? Would getting a decent raise put excessive pressure on you to excel or make you more expensive than your peers, which could cause resentment and make you more likely to end up on the next layoff list? Would it be wise to see if the employer will, without your asking, give you a good raise, maybe at your next performance review? Well, if you think this is a good time to ask, maybe the following plan will help. First, we've got to talk about preparation, which is crucial. Ongoing, keep a list of your accomplishments, especially those that increased the employer's revenue. Also, take note of any increased responsibilities you're likely to have moving forward, you know, in the next couple of months. The second list I want you to compile is a list of comparable salaries within and outside your organization. Yes, start by asking your peers, but you also might consult Glassdoor.com, Payscale.com, Salary.com, and maybe even your professional association, you know, like the American Psychological Association or whatever. Very often they conduct salary surveys. Well, very often it's too strong. Some of them do. Next thing you want to do is you want to email those two lists, the list of your accomplishments and the list of comparable salaries, probably with an adjustment based on your geography, based on your particular job, etc. Email those two lists to your boss, along with a request to discuss your compensation. That makes it clear you're taking it seriously. You're not just off the cuff asking. You need to, in advance, decide on a salary offer that would be the best that's reasonable, a salary offer that would be satisfactory, and a salary offer that would be the least you would take. And please do remember, though, that any increase in salary would be taxable at your top rate, which usually adds up to about 50% when you include federal, state, local, Social Security, workers' comp, Medicare, and Medicaid taxes. And then anything that you buy after all that tax will be taxed at, you know, depending on which county you live in, at almost 10%. So the important thing is, how much would your quality of life improve based on a pay raise? It may be smaller than you think. So it may be wise to focus in your negotiation on the non-cash aspects of compensation, which aren't taxable. And here are some good examples. Changing your job description to better match your strengths and your preferences. Change who you report to, maybe some up-and-comer or some great person who's a great boss rather than a fire-breathing dragon. Your title. If you get a better title, it could help you if you're looking for a job outside to get a better job, or it simply can accord you more respect in the workplace. And we're allowed a little bit of, be able to feel good about ourselves if we've got a title of, you know, senior director rather than director, for example. Other examples of non-taxable things you could negotiate for is telecommuting. As I've said a number of times on this show, the commutes are getting ever more exhausting and long. And so if you can, for at least 1 or 2 days a week, telecommute, you're saving hours of time, wear and tear in your car, and you're probably going to be more effective as an employee. So it's the kind of thing that many employers will at least allow you to do a trial of. You might want to negotiate for a training budget, maybe a bigger one than you normally would get. Now, there's something where it's not taxable, you benefit because you grow, and the employer benefits. So it's the kind of negotiable item that employers tend to say yes to. especially if you've got a specific thing you want. Let's say there is this fabulous conference that just happens to be in Hawaii that you would like to go to, and it would be expensive. Maybe the registration is $500 or $1,000, and the airfare is $1,000, and the hotels. That's a heck of a benefit you could get that's worth a fortune, not taxable, and yet one that the employer might well go along with. You might, you know, many employers of any size have a 401k, or if it's a nonprofit, a 403b, but in many cases, the employer doesn't match the employee contribution. If you can get them to match, that's a cash benefit that is not taxable. Great thing to negotiate. Now, a lot of times, I'm very well aware that in many, many workplaces, that's not negotiable, but this sometimes it is, so I'm mentioning it. One item I don't want you, in addition to the cash, I don't want you to overestimate the importance of stock options. Unless it's already a public company, with those stock options strike price, that is, the price at which you can buy the stock, is significantly below its current price, stock options, especially if it's a startup, usually end up being worth zippo, zero, nada, as I am wont to say. Now let's turn to the negotiation itself. Usually, it's best for your demeanor to match your negotiating partners, that is the bosses in this case, soft with soft, tough with tough. But a rule of thumb might be softer on the person, harder on the terms. Regarding salary, you've got two choices, basically. As soon as possible in the negotiation. The reason I'm saying soon is because you don't want the employer to say necessarily what do you want. You'd rather it come from him. But there are two options. So early on, I'd like you to say in that negotiation meeting, ask either of these two things. Well, Mr. or Ms. Boss, in light of the comparable salaries I showed you and the accomplishments I sent you, what is the most you're comfortable paying me? The word comfortable takes some of the edge off, and yet it still uses the word most, so it could extract a good offer. But there's another alternative that's worked very well for a number of my clients, and that is this. Asking, in light of the comparable salaries I sent you, and in light of the accomplishments I sent you, it would seem fair that a X percent raise, maybe 20%, would be fair. What do you think? That, by establishing a relatively high number, it's you're starting the negotiation from where you want, and it avoids the lowball where they offer you 2%, and then it's really hard to climb up from there. But let's say the employer does lowball you, or says no, like says, I'm sorry, we can't give you a raise right now, the budget's tight, and it just wouldn't be fair to your peers. Well, you might respond with something like, I understand you're under pressure. Is there anything about my rationale for that 20% raise that's unfair? That puts the pressure on him or her to come up with some reason for it being unfair. And then the next technique I love is just the pregnant pause. After he says or she says whatever it is, wait. And he offers you 5%. Look him or her in the eye and wait. Sometimes that pause is enough to make that person feel uncomfortable to tease out an extra few grand without you even having to open your mouth. And that's great because it avoids the oppositionality that can result in enmity between you and the boss, and you end up paying a bigger price than the few grand pre-tax is worth. But there's going to be a point at which you sense it's not worth pushing more on the pay issue. So at that point, you want to say something like, well, why don't we set the pay issue aside for now? There are a few non-cash items that it seems fair to ask for. By the way, it may be wise to focus on just two or three items that you care most about. Maybe it's telecommuting and maybe it's a training budget or whatever. Because you focus on too much, you're increasing the risk that you're going to be seen as a pain, and then more likely to just create enough enmity that the boss is going to, you know, just think more of you when it comes time to creating a layoff list or think not of you when it comes time who to give a plum assignment to or promotion. Now, of course, there are no firm rules about when the benefits of pushing harder outweigh the risks, but I like to offer rules of thumb, and one that has worked in general for my clients, I think works all the time: reject the first offer, accept the second. Why? Because anything more that you get after the second offer is usually small compared with the risk of too alienating your boss. And again, that alienation can impose quite a price. It can make you more likely to be laid off. It can avoid the boss giving you a plum assignment. He can make him or her tough on you when it comes time to, you know, to evaluate what you've turned in, to agree or not agree with what you propose in a meeting. So you always need to, you know, be circumspect and look in the broader picture. What is the quality of life increase that's going to accrue from winning, quote, winning the battle? And will you be losing the war if you win that battle? It's a balancing act, like so much of life. But let's say now you're dissatisfied with the outcome of your negotiation. You can often still salvage something by saying something like, well, I know I'm going to be doing a good job for you, so can I at least have an accelerated compensation review, say in 6 months rather than the usual 1 year? You can often at least get that, because the boss is committing to nothing, and you've got a second bite at the apple. Of course, with human beings, nothing works all the time. But I like to think that the plan, those tactics I just outlined for you, do boost your chances of negotiating successfully, especially in this time of historic low unemployment. Now, I'd like to invite you to call. You can certainly call if you've got a question about your compensation, or if you're the boss. You know, we like to be an equal opportunity talk show here. Whether you are the worker bee, a boss who is in a position to negotiate salary for somebody else or for yourself. If you have a question about negotiation, I'll try to provide a customized answer for you. And as well, whatever your work problem is or that of someone you care about, you can also call in. All of these are what I call workovers with no pummeling involved usually. And this is a great time to call when the lines are available. So if you would like a workover here at KALW and work with Marty Nemko, the phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I now want to talk a little bit about why career counseling clients fail. There are lessons here for individuals and for counselors. People in the media, including me, tend to present success stories. But of course, a lot can be learned from failure. So here I want to describe some common ways in which my career counseling clients have failed and what individuals can do, as well as counselors can do to help. I want to start by talking about career exploration. Typically, career counselors help clients identify career areas to explore. And for homework, I have them do some reading and watching of videos before they reach out to talk with one or more people in the field. It's a good way to explore the career. Anyway, too often, though, the client's Googling skills, Google search skills, turn out to be inadequate. I have come to realize that Google searching is a perhaps surprisingly demanding skill. It requires excellent reasoning ability to figure out the right search terms, to know when it's worth digging into a site, when it's not. It's really quite an art. Now, occasionally, I often try to teach the client how to improve their Google search skills, and that sometimes works. But as often, it may be as wise to accept that reasoning skills are difficult to improve, especially within the amount of time that you have to learning it before you find a job, or if within the amount of time a career counselor has to work within a client. So that career counselor or you are often wise to identify, if you're the counselor, to identify the specific articles and videos the client should review. And the person who's self-directed in trying to explore careers, who has difficulty unearthing material that's on target, might be wise to use an all-in-one site. There's one that's called mynextmove.org, which it makes it easy. It asks you specific questions about what you're looking for in a job, your skills, your interests, your values, and then matches you to a career. Now, notice, by the way, I'm not saying I'm telling you to run to a career counselor. Very often, and I'm a big believer in self-learning. I like the agency and the empowerment and the cost saving and the time saving that comes from that. Of course, last resort, you can always see a career counselor. But even if you're not great at digging up what you should be doing with your life or Googling, searching to learn about a career, try a tool like mynextmove.org or my book, Careers for Dummies, which has little descriptions of 350 careers and a specific link to a website with more information on the career. My Next Move also has, for every career that you get matched with, there's an article and or video. And it also links to institutions that offer training for that career. It's great. MyNextMove.org, good website. Now let's turn to why career counseling clients fail in job seeking. But first, I'd like to give out the phone number again. If you have a work-related problem, I'd like to try to help you with what I call a workover. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Back to job seekers. For most people, job seeking isn't fun. Putting yourself out there usually results in you just getting ignored or rejected. And when you're not, you're subjected to stressful interviewing and negotiation. Plus, you're having to craft a compelling LinkedIn profile, resumes that are custom for the job opening, cover letters that are custom for a job opening, and maybe collateral materials such as a work sample, a white paper, or a business proposal. Not very fun. So it's not surprising that a lot of job seekers procrastinate. They're just somehow not motivated enough to do that hard work, or, as the shrinks would have us believe, to push past the fear of rejection, the fear of embarrassment, the fear of imposing, even the fear of success. And that is especially likely. They're especially unlikely to push through if someone else is supporting them. If they got a spouse supporting them, parents supporting them, inheritance, or the taxpayer, there isn't that sense of urgency that they've got to, you know, do a thorough job search. Procrastinating that job search is also likely if the job seeker lacks the foundational value that being productive and self-supporting is not negotiable, that being responsible is cosmically required. Now, if you're the job seeker or you're their counselor, you can boost motivation using maybe one or more of these. First of all, you need to assess if that job target is not too demanding and not too easy. Because clearly, if it's too demanding, you're going to tend to want to procrastinate doing it. If it's too easy, it's not going to feel motivating enough to do it either. You should accept, as I just mentioned earlier, that central to the life well led is being productive and self-supporting. Another way to boost your motivation would be to break down the job hunt into those proverbial baby steps, which can be charted. I've talked about this before on the radio. When my wife was finishing her, she had about a year or two left in her PhD, and she was really frustrated with the process. We made a little thermometer, like those church thermometers with, you know, that normally it has $10,000, $20,000, $50,000, whatever, and it gets filled in as the money gets raised. We put all the milestones toward her getting her PhD, and every time she completed a milestone, we colored it in purple pen, and I gave her a hug in front, and I put the thermometer, was that thermometer was on the refrigerator, and I gave her a hug in front of the refrigerator. That can help. Another help for motivation is to stay vigilant to maintain the right level of perfectionism, not slipshod, yet not taking too long by being unnecessarily perfectionistic. Then, of course, there are the standard anti-procrastination techniques. And I've mentioned these ad nauseum in previous shows, so I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to remind you of the one-second task. I've just finished doing my income taxes. It's one of those tasks I don't like doing. And so I am so often tempted to procrastinate, and sometimes I succumb. But what helps me get on track more than anything else is, okay, what's the next one-second task? What's the next one-second task? What's the next one-second task? And that can help me. You know, the object in motion is then to stay in motion. Another way to build your motivation to look for a job is to picture, literally picture, the benefit of landing a job. Maybe if your dream is to have the white picket fence house, show a picture of that. And it may not be in the Bay Area because the price is so crazy, but maybe in Montana, where you can buy a house for $100,000, I think, still. You can even find it, you know, you can picture it in your mind, but you might even print out a JPEG of kind of the house you envision and put it as your computer's wallpaper, you know, that's at the back of your screen. You can just Google computer wallpaper. Adobe has it. It's free. You can, it's a little app that you can use to make that your wallpaper. That picturing that benefit can be motivating. Now, I want to talk about my career counseling clients who have given up on their job search. Here are some reasons. First, they have an inflated self-assessment of the kind of job that they will be top of the heap for you. You know, because these days, unfortunately, especially for an advertised job, there could be dozens, if not hundreds, of applicants. And you need to be, you know, the top one. The job usually goes to one person. Well, an antidote is to ask yourself, or colleagues, or career counselor, this question. In that most publicly advertised jobs get many applications, what is the probability that I will be at least among the top contenders for this job? If you can do that, you'll be less likely to get rejected and ignored and more likely to have a better hit ratio. Other of my career counseling clients give up on the job search because they focused their interview preparation. They didn't listen to me when I said canned answers are going to kill you. They end up preparing, you know, my greatest strengths, greatest weaknesses, and they ask me, you know, ask me common questions and let's work out a scripted answer. Well, they end up sounding scripted or insincere, and it certainly lacks the necessary interpersonal chemistry. Interview preparation should focus on developing a few PAR stories. PAR is an acronym that stands for a problem you faced that's related to the kind of job you're vying for. The clever or dogged way you approached it, that's the A in PAR, and the positive result, that's the R in PAR, problem, approach, result. Also worthy is developing a mindset that says, I'm going to be authentic, including revealing an immutable weakness, a weakness that's hard to improve, that the job might require. I'm going to humanly connect in the interview. And I'm going to think that if I don't get the job, it probably means there's a better fit job for me somewhere else. That's got to be the mindset. That's going to keep you from being desperate. It's going to keep you authentic. It's going to be both ethically right and more likely to help you get the job you deserve and avoid your giving up prematurely. Other of my career counseling clients give up on their job search because they are focusing too much on low payoff activities, primping their resume and their LinkedIn profile. Too much time on that interview preparation. Too much time acquiring skills that may not be crucial on whatever job they're going to end up with. The focus should usually be on tapping your network connections that are stronger than the paper-thin LinkedIn connections. And if you need to, build your network, for example, by attending or presenting at conferences, writing an article for a trade publication, being active in an online professional forum or an in-person professional forum. Also, if it's not too intimidating for you, a good use of job search time is to write, phone, or even walk in to target employers, asking for advice, and even to propose working for them, if only as a volunteer or an intern or as a fill-in worker. Those are high payoff activities, and by focusing on the high payoff activities, not the low payoff activities, you're less likely to give up prematurely. Another reason that career counseling clients give up on their job search is they spend too little time on it. Unsuccessful job seekers do what I call a drips and drab search, in which they spend just a couple of hours a week. As a result, they too infrequently get encouraging news, for example, that they're a finalist for some job, and so after a few months of this drips and drab, they give up. Successful job seekers, if they're unemployed, spend 30 hours a week on the job search, of actual job searching time, along the lines I've been describing, or if you're working full-time, that you can't be expected to work 30 hours a week, but at least 5 to 10 hours a week. Not at least, 5 to 10 hours a week is about right. And a final reason that career counseling clients give up on their job search is their job search is too diffuse. In their desperation to land a job, they apply to a too wide range of roles in multiple fields. So in the job search process, they never learn enough about a particular role or field. The successful job seekers focus on just one or two roles and one or two fields, like product manager and project manager in enterprise productivity software and or in genomic research software. The final area where my career counseling clients tend to quit is when they're already on the job. A common reason for failure on the job is in their having used job search tactics to land a job that's more challenging than they're truly qualified for. for example, lying on their applications and interviews and convincing people to give a stronger reference than they deserve. Now, that can occasionally land an applicant the job, but on the job, the disparity between the pre-hiring performance and the post-hiring performance is often a shock to the employer, which leads the employer to quickly terminate the employee. I remember, for example, a person who was very tech-light, not very, she was pretty tech-light, and she really wanted to work for a website that was aimed at middle-aged women. It was thirdage.com, I believe. That could be wrong. The only job opening at that place was for a tech-savvy person. She had a friend help her with the at-home tech tests that were offered. And as a bright person, she managed to BS her way through the interviews, and she got hired. But she struggled on the job. And a few weeks later, she crashed the website, and of course, thereupon, she was fired. Other people fail in the job because of lack of soft skills, emotional intelligence, the art of persuasion, being high maintenance, being too insistent you're right when it's not, you know, it's not worth the fight, or calling out others' mistakes even when they're minor. Now, fixing those such weaknesses, ameliorating such weaknesses, it requires concerted effort. Like, I was just talking to Joanne Marr before the show, and she's journaling about something. And journaling your daily successes, your feelings, your failures is a great way to unearth your own issues or things you want to remember or whatever. So again, notice I'm always trying to focus, rather than running to send you to a counselor, which would also simply be seen as maybe self-serving, I really do, from an ethical perspective, think it's really important to try to do these self-help kind of techniques, of which journaling is a particularly potent one. Anyway, ultimately, the person who is successful in their career takes a moderate amount of time to identify a career and a job target or two that use their strengths and skirt their weaknesses, that these people prioritize integrity. I know I sound like a Boy Scout, but they really do prioritize integrity and hard work. I've seen that in some of the most successful people. Successful people are often deemed as likely to be unethical because the unethical ones make the newspapers, make the headlines. But at least I can say that most of the successful people I know really, really do value ethics. They're not saints, but they really do consider ethics a lot. And they work hard in landing the job and recognizing that on the job that the soft skills can matter as much as the hard. Anyway, those are, I hope, some lessons learned that can be learned for you if you are on the job or looking for a job, or if you're a career counselor or any other kind of counselor. In any event, if you have a question about your work life, or if you are a helping professional who's got a problem with one of your clients or patients, anything related to work is fair game. I invite you to call. And the first person to call will get a free autographed copy of my book, Careers for Dummies. So you'll, at the end of the call, just stay in the line, give your name and address to Joanne, my engineer board operator person, and I will send you an autographed copy of Careers for Dummies. For whether you want the book or not, if you would like some free advice, the phone number here at Work with Marty and M. Cohen, KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Also, you know, another reason you might want to call is I love stories, and I think we all love stories. Did anything happen to you at work this week that made you happy, angry, sad, frustrated? Do you have a success story this week or a failure story or merely something that's interesting or instructive? Those are all good reasons. The only common denominator, the thread, call for anything to do with Rated to Work, whether it's a question or a story. The phone number again at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We've got calls coming in, so I'm just going to wait a moment until the call is ready before I don't want to launch into anything else, and I'm going to, just as they say, tap dance for a minute. I guess what I'll do is, since I might have a moment here, I'm going to just read you one of my tweets that I like. I wrote, how foolish we are that we, especially in romance, but also in the workplace, let appearance trump substance. Let me do one more and then I'll go to the phones. Am I the only person who thinks that TED Talks are overrated? TED Talks' required formula converts interesting people to robots, leeching the imperfections, the humanity that differentiates a talk from text. If you're a speaker, list a few talking points, and then just trust that you will do better by extemping. All right, now we got lots of calls on the line. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello?
Marty, are
yes,
you there?
I am.
Wow. I don't think I've spoken on the radio in at least 15 years.
Wow. Well, congratulations. How does it feel, as they say?
Well, I feel pretty good, actually, and I really appreciate your show.
Thank
and
you.
That's why I took the time to call, because I've been really enjoying it.
I appreciate that. Do you have a story to tell or a question to ask?
Well, I just was touched by your admissions of trying to do a good show, and I love KLLW, and we got a staticky line here. Can you hear it?
Yeah, I hear you. It's, I can, so keep it brief. And
well, that's my question. It's a staticky line. How do I approach what's now AT&T, used to be Pac Bell, about a line that I've been paying for 40-odd years, and I can't get them to repair it or fix it, and they keep jacking up the price and sending me unsolicited robotic phone calls? How would I approach a thing like that?
I'll give you a brief answer because you were so kind, but it's off topic. So in the end, you know, the key word here is escalation. When you call customer service and they blow you off, I'll just role play. I can only
been there, done that.
Okay.
That didn't help.
Okay, well, let's. I may not be able to help you, but let me tell you what the wording, sometimes it's all in the wording. I'll tell you how I would do it. Let's say the person gets on the line, the level one customer service person. Oh yeah, well we'll do this and we'll do that and we'll do that. I would preempt that by saying, I'm sure you're sick and you know, you're a customer service rep. You're probably sick of angry customers, but you've got one here too.
No, I'm just a customer.
I know. No. I'm role playing. I'm pretending.
Okay,
pretending.
I got you. Thanks,
right.
Marty.
I'm saying, you know, I'm sure you're a customer service rep and you're sick and tired of angry customers. And I got to admit that I'm one of them. But I'm really frustrated, and maybe you can help me. I've been getting a staticky line forever. I have called a number of times, and they promise they're going to fix it, and they don't. They sent me this, and they did that. Is this something you can do, or should you escalate this? I'm in your. It's really frustrating the heck out of me.
I'm about ready to give it up, Marty. I'm about ready to just tell them to cancel it and stop paying.
Absolutely. Well, you know, AT&T is, you know, I switched from AT&T. I'm not a big Comcast fan, but they're reliable. It's ridiculously expensive. I can't stand how much they charge, but at least they are very reliable. But AT&T was always a problem for me. What they told me was that my house was very far from the central station, and therefore I was not going to get reliably crisp internet access and phone.
I'm not even trying for internet. I'm talking about basic phone service.
All right. You know what? I'm going to have to say, because this is so off topic, I was trying to be generous just because you were nice to me, but I got it. All our lines are lighted up, and my job is to serve people on their career problem. Thank you for listening to the show. Maybe Sonic, you know, I've heard good things about Sonic.net. Maybe you can try that. Okay. Thanks for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Okay. So my name is Ian.
Hi, Ian.
And I just wanted to, like, run through and validate what I've heard already is so. I've been involved in career research for about 20 years, reading Nelson Bowles and John C. Crystal, Where Do You Go From Here With Your Life? And I just want to make sure you, like, everybody knows that everything that you've said is spot on.
Wow, thank you.
Like, absolutely spot on, and I'm looking forward to, like, perusing your book. So I'm in career transition. I'm going from a technology...
By the way, you're the first career-related call. I want you to get my book for free. So after we finish our call, stay on the line and give Joanne your name and address, and I will send you an autographed copy of Careers for Dummies, as promised. The other person was talking about something nothing to do with careers. So I don't feel right about giving him the book, but I feel right about giving you the book, okay?
Okay, great. Thank you
cool.
so much.
Go ahead. Now, go ahead.
Okay, so I'm transitioning from a career in technology, which was paying me about $40 an hour, to a career in construction, which is paying about $20 an hour.
Wow.
And I landed, like, the perfect job.
Okay.
A construction company, they want computer help, and they want construction. So now I'm, like, in the transition from a lot of office work into a lot of field work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to make sure that I stay on the path I'm on. And that's why you listed a few things to avoid in as far as a new job. And I'd like you to list those again, because every single one was like, bam, 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 absolutely perfect. One of them was this: develop and use your emotional intelligence.
Yeah. Well, I'm deliberately, I don't know exactly what I said, but I'm going to say, if I was starting this new job in a new field, here is a list of the things I would do. I'd first make sure, if possible, I was reporting to a boss, if I had some discretion, who I felt was going to be a good mentor, and I would be open about my strengths and weaknesses. I'm saying, you know, I have really good IT strengths in these areas, but I don't know much about the construction industry, so I hope you won't feel, you know, bad, you won't be mad at me if I ask you some questions. I really want to succeed on the job. So that's a great thing to do. And then asking, are there some specific things about this organization that I should understand? I don't want to, you know, step into it without realizing it. There are always cultural norms, everything from lunch hour to whether we should curse to whatever. And if you're concerned about making the $20 an hour, say, you know, I'm happy, I'm excited to be in construction, but I'm not sure I can live on $20 an hour in the crazy Bay Area. What advice do you have for me as to how I could move back to my $40 an hour? What do I need to do to add enough value that I'm worth $40 an hour? Those are the kind of things I would do to start. Does any of that feel helpful?
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Because, so, as part of my job, and as any job that I have, part of that job is salesman. And yep. As a salesman, my boss is my customer.
Yes.
And so there's two like main important things. The first thing is I always have to get communication with him, so, you know, asking, you know, what is
that? You're kind of cutting out. Can you move into a better reception area by any chance?
Well, I'm parked at the side of a road.
Okay, go ahead.
So the first thing is like I want to be in communication with him about like what works for him and what he values.
Correct.
And then the second thing is I always want to ask him like, what could I do better? You know, what do you think? And then also, like, how does he think I will fit into the corporate culture? And how, like, problems that he's had in the past?
Couple of thoughts about that. Different bosses are more open and less open to lots and lots of questions. So you may want to ask him. You say, you know, I recognize every boss is a little different. And, of course, as soon as possible, I'm going to reduce the questions. Will you be annoyed with me if I'm asking a lot of questions in the beginning? So you've kind of put him on notice, which is helpful. And I love your question about, you know, there was somebody doing this job in the past. Are there any lessons that I could learn from the previous incumbent that would help me do a better job here? Those are perfectly reasonable questions to ask.
And I also want to bring up that you mentioned integrity as far as... And so the thing is, like you said, I can't stress that enough. And I talk to my coworkers about it, and I talk to my boss about it. It's like, do what you say you're going to do and be very, like, careful. Like, absolutely be on time. Never, on time means late, so always be early.
Couple of thoughts about that as well.
Yeah.
I recognize everything requires nuance in life. Mm-hmm. But I've especially seen, especially in startups, that are desperate to not go out of business. They still have the stars in their eyes of stock options and going public. There is a lot of corner cutting that goes on in Starbucks. You have to be particularly vigilant there. And frankly, and this seems paradoxical, but even in nonprofits, they're so committed to the cause and their money is so central to their continued existence that they also tend to stretch the truth. So especially in my experience, at least in my client's experience, if you're working for a startup in the for-profit sector, or you're working for a nonprofit that has real true believers or true ideologues, you have to be really vigilant to make sure that you keep your integrity, but lest you be seen as somebody who's like this minister who's preachy and holier than thou, you have to carefully strike the balance between, yes, calling out unethical behavior, but maybe not being too purist of it. If it really is so unethical a place, you got to get out. But if I'm working for a startup and they're frantically trying to stay in business and make payroll, and there's some little minor little crappy thing they do, you may want to shut up. You want to try to keep your ethics, but being a purist is not always required. What's your reaction to that?
Be discreet. Absolutely. Temperate.
Yeah. You're almost like going through life being the wise judge. Sometimes you want to be the hanging judge and impose a serious sentence, you know, really call them on their unethics or whatever. And sometimes you say, you know what, you know, let's let this slide a little bit. I'll just happen to look the other way. I think about the health inspectors, you know, where they're going to a restaurant and they see a problem that really is very unlikely to hurt patron's health or whatever, but it's in violation of the code and it costs thousands of dollars and it's a little family-run business. And the really wise and ethical inspector, in my judgment, would look the other way. But other times, if they're deliberately doing things that are really hurting to the patrons, and it wouldn't cost that much, and let's say it was a massively profitable restaurant, then you're going to be the hanging judge. So I like the idea of going through life not being not judgmental. I believe in going through life being judgmental, but being judgmental where wisdom is the undergirding principle. Does that make any sense?
Just reading about how people like Elon Musk today are driven by, fundamentally by their underlying principles. Like that's the thing that causes them to prioritize and do what they do and plan and do the actions that they do. But it's the underlying principle that drives
them. Yeah. You know, sometimes I wonder whether that's also public. I'll take Elon Musk for an example. I happen to know somebody who works for Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
It's a remarkably unreliable car.
Yeah.
It is near the bottom, and it's really hard to get service as well. If Elon Musk was really about ethics, he's got all that money in the world, he would say, you know what, we had a great vision, but it is not working. So rather than subject customers to probably, they're spending $70,000, $100,000, $150,000 on a car because it's cool and it's electric and it's fast. But the really ethical thing, and I there's much I don't know. This is an opinion based on too little. But based on what I've heard from this insider, the really ethical thing you should do is close it down and use all that money on something with a higher probability of doing good for humankind. What do you think?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. After Consumer Reports review, I asked.
Right. Exactly. I saw that, and I've heard that. I read the Consumer Reports thing, and I really believe in Consumer Reports, but then I heard a firsthand report from somebody, I'll just say, somebody inside who really is in a position to know. Anyway, all right, all our lines are lighted up, so I want to thank you very much for the call. I hope that, congratulations on the new job. I hope you do well in it and even get your salary back up to more than $20 an hour, because it's tough to live on that.
Great. Thank you so much, Marty. Have a great evening.
You too. Be well. Back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I wanted to know your opinion about starting a vision board workshop business. And the two things that I'd like to know would be what you think the demand would be and how helpful you think it would be.
First of all, am I correct that vision boarding is like creating visions for your life, different about your professional life, your personal life, etc.? Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me about your empirical experience with it so far. What have you done? What efforts have you made to do it? How much money have you made? How much repeat business? The ultimate determination of whether somebody thinks what you do is good is if they come back for a second round or they refer people and you're making good money. If you're doing it for nothing or for $10 or $25, you have a lovely volunteer thing, a lovely hobby. But I need to hear from a business perspective, because you're talking about doing this to make a living. Tell me what your experience so far has been in terms of repeat business, how much money you've been getting, etc.
Well, I'm at the embryonic stage. And so I was trying to see if, people like you thought there might be a demand. I mean, my feeling is that having people explore options and choices would yield empowerment.
Yeah, I mean, those are all true. And, of course, every shrink and career counselor and spiritual counselor and motivational coach is doing that as well. In this situation, when you're embryonic, I'm a huge fan of risk control, but not giving up the idea. I would start by inviting a few of your friends, 3, 5, 10, whatever, to your place if it's acceptable, or at a community room or whatever, and do one for free.
Okay.
Beg for honest feedback.
Okay.
Improve it. And then at the end, ask them, this is my attempt, this is my first baby step. What would be the most that you would pay for, would pay for something like this, and beg for their honesty? Say, if it's zero, please tell me you're going to save me the embarrassment and the time and money of setting up this business. If it's $500, I want to know that too. So do a freebie for your friends. That's a low-risk, easy-to-do action. And then at the end, ask for their candid feedback about the most that they... It's not whether they liked it or not. That's all well and good. Okay? And then people are going to say they like it. It's just too hard to say, no, I think it stunk. but asking them a specific question like, please be honest with me, you're going to save me tremendous hell of starting a new business. What is the most you'd be willing to pay for something like this? Zero, 50, 100, 500, whatever. And if you're given, not everybody has to say they'd spend $100, that's fine. But if a reasonable percentage say they would spend, say, 50 even on it, that gives you reason to try a baby step forward. So if there is an organization that you're a member of, a church, a spiritual group, a networking group, your workplace or whatever, say, okay, it's $10. We're going to do one. We're going to do a 1 hour, and it's $10, and you try that. You build it organically with low risk. Then once, if it's really building up momentum and there's high satisfaction and you offer, the standard model is, you offer the freebie for 1 hour, then you offer a half-day workshop for $100, and then you upsell that to a weekend for $495, and then there's a series of videos that you sell online, but you take it a step at a time. And
okay.
Some of these businesses can grow so it can be a sustainable living or even get you rich, and others just go by the wayside. But I'm a huge fan of trying of low-risk actions. I've said that 10 million times to my clients. Low-risk actions, not rumination. You learn more from, after a bit of rumination, you learn more from a low-risk action than from additional rumination. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I did explore it with one person, you know, did just a one-on-one, and the feedback I got was that for that individual, I was really surprised, for that individual, they felt that choices meant pressure on them. And I thought, wow.
People are so individual. That's what, you know, it is some, that's
yeah.
why I figured get 10 people. So you've got at
yeah.
least some
okay.
kind of a sample size.
Okay.
I don't want
okay.
you to get dispirited based on an N of one.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Nope. I was a little dispirited.
It's premature. It's premature. Yeah, but okay. what you could do is, you know, with that person's candor, saying, okay, how could I, is that kind of pressure a bad thing or is it a good thing? What could have made it a good thing? Probe a little more. So maybe that person's feedback is useless and is no, of no value, but sometimes there could be a lesson learned in it.
Okay. So probe. Wonderful. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. When you're in the embryonic stage, you're primarily in learning mode. You're learning what that vision boarding thing should look like, how it should be marketed, how long it should be, what are the kind of objections they would have, how can you make it more beneficial. You're in learning mode. You're, as the Buddhists would say, you have a beginner's mind. And then,
excellent.
Okay? All right. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks.
Back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Yeah, my name is Tim.
Hi, Kim.
And I have kind of a strange problem that is in some ways enviable. About a year ago, I left a big company, big tech company. I work in software as an engineering manager.
Mm-hmm.
I've also done coding before.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a startup that was 15 minutes away, and that was great for being close to my family.
Right.
But then 6 months ago, I ended up with an opportunity and bought a house.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm commuting about 2.5 hours.
Oh, my God.
In each direction, yes.
Oh, my God.
About 6 hours for 8 hours in the office.
From where? Where are you going? What's taking you 2.5 hours? Where are you going from? To where?
From Carmel Valley.
From Carmel Valley?
Yeah.
To the Bay Area?
Yeah, right.
Oh, my God. You must love that job.
I don't know. I'm a commitment-oriented person. I got the job first, and I had it for a while, and I do think that it's a good company and the good people there, but it does feel like it might be a little too much at this point.
Telecommuting? How much telecommuting do you do? How much could you do?
I transitioned into 4 days a week at the office, so one day a week at home, and now I'm trying to do 2 days a week at home, but even that feels like it's a bit too much.
Of course it's a lot. I'm just playing here. What if we went all the way and said you only came in on an as-needed basis, and that you're going to use Zoom and you're going to use phone and Google Hangout, whatever, in general, and whatever accountability they need, you're happy to send them. But I mean, that you're probably spending half your income, half your after tax income on car wear and tear. I don't care if you drive a smart car, you know.
I just, as a manager, I feel like one-on-ones have to be in person, and in order to help make things successful.
Now, what if I said it's old-fashioned thinking? You know what? You are less, you know, as somebody, when I started out as a career counselor 30 years ago, I did almost 100% of my sessions were in person. Now, 80% of my sessions, because of the traffic, and because I have a kind of an international clientele at this point, are by phone or Skype or Zoom. And I swear to you, my efficacy with my clients is no worse with my phone client, even phone clients, than I just got off, before I came here, I just got off the phone with a client in Toronto, and we just speak on the phone. And, you know, I'm wondering whether you need to revisit this need for one-on-ones being in person.
Yeah, I perhaps I've got a commitment issue, because I know that there are other people in the company. They're not managers, but they do work remotely. And it does feel like I'm reaching a kind of a burnout point on how long I've been maintaining this.
Any human being would. I mean, I find my... Look, I have to get here. It takes me... I only live 10 miles from here. I live just in Oakland. And it takes me an hour and 10 minutes to get here from Oakland because of the traffic, the 10 miles. And I'm finding myself stressed when I get here. And so I can imagine... And that's once a week. 2.5 hours each way, five days a week, 4 days a week. No, you know, I don't want you to... You're not a machine. You're a human being. You got to love yourself enough... that you deserve better than that. I swear you do.
Well, that's a good endorsement. When I brought up with my manager in January about, hey, I'm going to go to 3 days a week, he was like, well, I mean, maybe we could hold off for a bit. And that was unfortunate, because I had also brought it up in December, and he was like, yeah, okay, I mean, I think that makes sense. So I guess I'm kind of getting signals that, in a soft way, they're... I can negotiate to do this, I suspect, but I'm just reluctant to...
You know what? You're seeming like a nice guy. You know, there are times to be gentle and times to be tough. I think the door sounds wide enough open. I'm going to role play what I would say to your boss. I say, what's your boss's first name?
Jim.
Jim. Jim, you know, I really appreciate you having been open to my telecommuting. Can I be really honest with you, Jim? I'm exhausted by the time I get to work and when I get home. You know, 5 hours each day, 4 days a week is 20 hours a week. You're getting a less good worker. You're getting a less happy worker. You're getting a worker who's even burning out and tempted to look for another job. I like you, Jim, and I like this work, but I've got to fully take you up on your offer and even ask one bit more. I would like to come in only on an as-needed basis. I'm aware that there are times when it's a ticklish one-on-one where it really shouldn't be done by phone. You don't fire somebody, or you don't introduce some major new initiative by phone or Skype. But in general, I need to work at home. You're going to get a better worker out of me, and one who's going to be more stable. And you'll feel like a better boss because you're treating me, you know, with the flexibility you treat some of your other workers who work remotely. Jim, what do you think? That's how I would word it. What do you think he would say to that?
Yeah, I think you're right. That would be a good starting point. It might mean that they would transition some of the responsibilities I have.
Great.
But that's probably better, yes.
Of course it is. Great. Was there, you implied that wasn't the real reason you were calling. That was almost preliminary. Were you talking about looking for another job or something else? Because I kind of deliberately jumped the gun, maybe. Was I right?
I'm a longtime listener of your show, and I'm really a fan of your practical advice. You're very patient, including the first caller tonight. So I think, in a sense, sometimes I wonder, but I think, I, as you can tell, I move things carefully. You know, I have a mortgage now. I need to be aware of where my situation is, that I don't want to start something. Although I do get job offers every other day through LinkedIn. Yeah, it's how it is in tech, right? It's not a real offer. It's a, please join our recruiting pipeline.
Yes, yes.
But that's, yeah, so I think long term I may want to figure out how things work, but starting remote, you've given me quite a bit of confidence to take up that conversation. As the expression goes, the worst that'll happen is that I'll only get half of what I'm asking for, which is way better than where I am now, right?
Exactly. I want to make one other little point. You know, I've spent some time in the Monterey, Pacific Grove, Carmel Valley area myself, and it's a lovely place to live. You know, the traffic isn't so crazy, the people are more relaxed. And I'm, you know, as I walk down the streets of Oakland, and I do a lot of walking with my doggie, I'm seeing everybody, you look between people's eyes, and everybody's stressed. Nobody will establish eye contact with you. Nobody makes conversation. I was in Trader Joe's yesterday, and I was looking at the, we were looking at the, there was another person there looking at the eggs, and I made some little joke about the cage-free eggs, and there's so many choices, the extra large, the large, the brown, the white, the organic, the not. And we had a lovely conversation. She said, you know, I rarely have a conversation with people here in Oakland. I'm from England, and this is something we would do all the time. So I'm just wondering, especially if you were good enough to have made good money and have a very responsible job. I mean, being an engineering manager in Silicon Valley is no joke. The competition would be less down in Monterey County. I'm wondering whether you shouldn't start putting feelers out for opportunities, whether it be in Salinas or Monterey or Pacific Grove or you know, Carmel or whatever, about so that maybe you're, instead of having to push and be remote all the time, which can be isolating, maybe there's a better job awaiting you right in your backyard.
One then follow-up question would be, what do I do if Jim pushes back and's like, no, we really need you to do this. Where do I go from there?
I probably, because you're not ready to quit yet, I'd probably say reluctantly, I hope we can revisit this later and just shut up. You've gotten your answer. But that would make me redouble my efforts to try to find something else. So I'd get involved with online forums or in-person forums, user groups or whatever down in Monterey County. I might be somebody who's going to make, you know, give a talks at various IT or in leadership or management conferences that are down in Asilomar or other, you know, down there at various conference centers. Or I would be more outward, move outward going so that you got to be known in the Monterey County community as an IT leader. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay. I think, thank you. It's been great advice.
Great. Well, I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko. You take care and be well. Okay. Well, unfortunately, we don't, you know, as usual, there's still calls on the line, but we don't have time for the call. So please call. I begged you, please say call early in the show, and we'll get you on the air. But today we don't have time. So that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. Plus, I'm going to talk with someone I'm really excited about this show. Her name is Bella DiPaolo, and she is maybe the world's leading expert on being single in the workplace. There are lots of benefits of being single in the workplace. There are lots of challenges and pressures. We'll talk about all that. It's kind of a fresh topic. I'm looking forward to it. Anyway, until then, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.